We've been rocked by a record amount of natural disasters this year.
It's not just that we saw a whole bunch of these things all over the world. It's that these are outliers just by just about every measure, you know, in terms of strength, intensity, and area that these events have affected.
How climate change is making our world more dangerous to humans. I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 29th. Also on the show, U.S. treaties protecting tribal lands have rarely been honored, but that might be changing.
If you ever want to get a tribe riled up politically, threaten their treaty rights, and they will absolutely line up against whatever power is making that claim.
And we'll be talking about the new Netflix series, Bridgerton.
We were two separate societies, divided by color, until a king fell in love with one of us.
So let's get started.
Just like we need to be a unified nation in response to COVID-19, we need a unified national response to climate change. We need to meet the moment with the urgency it demands, as it would during any national emergency.
An extreme year for hurricanes, wildfires, and heat waves comes to an end.
Ada is the 28th named storm of the season. That ties it with 2005.
You could hear everything hitting the house, and it was literally moaning and cracking back and forth.
I said, Jack, are the four of us going to die in this house? See, that's how high the water got.
Outside my house, I have 18 inches of water all the way around my house.
The climate is not what it used to be. I do not remember this amount of dryness and this amount of fuel.
4 million now acres have been burned. 31 people have lost their lives. Close to 9,000 structures now have been destroyed.
I just about fell sideways. I could not believe the magnitude of the fire and how quickly it had grown. Out of control. This is insane.
You can't really go anywhere, and now, you know, but you can't go home.
In central Iowa, we recorded some wind gusts, 70, 75 miles per hour.
Think about entire counties that have been taken out. You know, over half of our crops have been devastated, about $4 billion worth of damage.
The intensity of this one kind of sets it apart. It was definitely a stronger derecho.
So I hurry up and I push the door back open, and there's this giant board just sticking out of the wall.
We're expecting up to 30 inches of rain, portions of Honduras, northern Nicaragua, Guatemala, and southern Belize. That type of rainfall can lead to life-threatening flash floods and mudslides.
We can expect to see further intensification of these extreme wildfire weather conditions.
Something's happened to the plumbing of the world. Climate change is real, and that is exacerbating this.
The pandemic may have consumed the majority of our attention this year, but it was not our only global crisis. Climate change in 2020 has led to some of the worst environmental disasters in history. There have been 41 weather disasters this year that have caused billions of dollars in damage. A record 18 of these took place in the U.S., with a year of historic wildfires, Atlantic hurricanes, and other severe weather fueled by climate change. Today, let's start with a look at the year in climate stories. What stands out, what we learned from a year when the climate crisis coincided with the coronavirus, and how we can look ahead into 2021. Joining me now is Umair Irfan, a staff writer at Vox covering climate change and science. Umair, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Callie.
And Jason Smerdon, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Jason, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Callie. Thanks for having me.
So, Jason, taking 2020 as a whole, what has happened to this planet when it comes to climate change? And how different do things look from a year ago globally?
Well, global warming has continued. Just because we had other crises didn't mean perpetual warming trend that we've been on now for over a century. It hasn't continued. So as far as the big picture goes, this year is likely to be in the top three warmest years on record. It could even possibly be the warmest year on record. And a lot has happened as that larger context has carried us along. So the Arctic is increasing and getting warmer much faster than the globe. We saw the second lowest sea ice extent in the Arctic since the 1970s. That accompanied things like fires in Siberia. So these global impacts, as you mentioned in the intro, have continued to pace in lots of different places. Closer to home, we've seen the hurricanes and the fires that you mentioned, as well as the extreme weather.
Umair, 2020 had some of the worst wildfires and hurricanes, as we've just mentioned, on record, linked, of course, to climate change. Can you give us a sense of how this year compared to years past?
I mean, as just noted, like, you know, a lot of these were record setting. Like in places like California, we saw a record area burned. We saw one of the largest wildfires on record. Colorado also saw one of its largest wildfires on record. The Atlantic Hurricane Basin this year saw its most active season on record. So generally just pushing the boundaries, and not just inside the United States. We saw in other countries, like you may remember at the beginning of the year, Australia saw massive wildfires. We saw massive typhoons in the Pacific Ocean, and all of these were basically pushing the boundaries as well of what we've seen. And so it's not just that we saw a whole bunch of these things all over the world. It's that even in the individual events we saw, you know, these are outliers just by just about every measure, you know, in terms of strength, intensity, and area that these events have affected.
So, Jason, are the links between extreme weather events and climate more clear now than they were in years past? And what did 2020 do for our understanding of things like the wildfires in Australia and California and this record-breaking hurricane season?
So the links are clear, but it really depends on the event. So things like the fires that we're seeing, the hurricane intensity, the strength of storms, those have real strong connections to the changing conditions due to global warming. So for instance, with hurricanes, and Umair mentioned that in the Atlantic Basin, we had a record year. We had 30 named storms. That's larger than any thing we've had since the 1800s. And those storms are getting stronger, and the connection between climate change and stronger hurricanes is very well resolved. Mainly, the hurricanes get their strength from the warm sea surface temperatures over which they form and travel, and there's a very clear connection between increasing sea surface temperatures globally and climate change. Similarly, with fires, the warmer and drier conditions that we're seeing, for instance, in the western United States, create much more favorable conditions for fire. And once fires start, allow fires to burn hotter and over larger areas. So in California, for instance, three of the four largest fires in California history happened this year. A lot of those fires were started by things like lightning strikes. But what that kind of random event is happening on top of is much drier conditions, much more favorable for fires. So the likelihood of those fires starting as a consequence of climate change is higher. And then once they've started, there's just much more fuel for them to burn over much larger areas.
Hmm. Umair, let's talk about the effect of climate change on people worldwide this year, especially the most vulnerable. How many people have been displaced as a result of climate change, and what does the financial toll look like?
Right. I mean, as you noted at the top, this is something that's been costing economies around the world, not just the U.S. economy, billions of dollars. They had, you know, dozens of disasters this year on their own with multi-billion dollar tolls. And as a consequence of that, you know, we do see a lot of displacement. People have been forced to relocate from the coast, particularly the Gulf Coast this year in the United States, like places like Louisiana saw multiple hurricane strikes, you know, spaced weeks apart. And so people had to be relocated. And that's even harder now with the pandemic going on and having to maintain social distancing. Similarly, in California, there were major evacuations as well out of these the paths of these massive record-breaking wildfires, and you're seeing multiple compounding disasters here, and that's kind of just exacerbating. It's not just climate change. It's also the fact that we have these systemic inequalities in our society, and also things like the pandemic. And when you have all these variables intersecting, that creates a much more devastating and longer-lasting toll. That's not just measured in the dollar amounts, but also in the trauma in these communities that, you know, have to be relocated and can't go back to the places that were home for generations.
Well, Umair, let's turn to the link between climate and COVID. What are some of the primary ways the pandemic affected our climate this year?
In the big picture, you know, we saw major global economic slowdown. You know, a lot of countries started shutting down. We saw roadways clear out and a lot of industries and businesses and offices closed down. And so there was especially at the outset, a major decline in energy consumption, and in a lot of places also a major decline in pollution. We saw, particularly in China, for instance, like pollution, like nitrogen oxides, for instance, rapidly decline in major cities as people stayed home. And we saw a big dip briefly in greenhouse gas emissions globally. But as businesses and offices and the economy started reopening, we actually saw a rebound where pollution and all these emissions all started spiking even higher than where they were before. So many of the gains were there, but they were short-lived as far as environmental benefits. And so we see now, you know, just how much of an economic dip is required to see these declines in greenhouse gas emissions, for instance, and we kind of have a better sense of what the challenge is that lies ahead as we're dealing with climate change over the coming century and trying to zero out global emissions. We get a better sense of just how much effort is involved in terms of the whole planet trying to mitigate this problem.
So, Jason, how do you think the pandemic has changed human behavior with regards to the planet? Do we know?
We know, for instance, that we're driving less and we're flying less, and that's where the big reductions in greenhouse gas emissions have occurred. And, you know, Umair presented this well. The one thing that I would say is that when we think about the kinds of changes that are necessary to decarbonize our economy, we would never pick a global pandemic as the option for doing that. So in terms of the parallels between what we need to do and what's happening under this pandemic, I think it only goes so far. But one of the things that I think is really important to take away from this is when we think about individual action, it's hard to imagine any more advanced individual actions than we've taken over this year, as many of us have stayed home, as we've stopped flying and traveling and so on. And yet, in terms of the overall number of amount of emission reductions this year, we're going to come in at probably about an 8% reduction relative to 2019 levels. And that's with a massive, essentially individual amount of actions that we've all taken that you might list as things that we need to do to curb greenhouse gas emissions. But there's still a lot of things that are fundamentally tied to fossil fuels. So we were still at home using our computers, heating our homes. That's all tied to, in many cases, electricity production, which is dependent on fossil fuels in a significant way. Industry still continued in different ways, which is still very dependent on fossil fuels. So I think one of the things that it actually demonstrated is that individual action only goes so far, and what we really need to decarbonize our economy is a much more systemic, wide-scale effort that still is within reach, but isn't something that necessarily happened during this pandemic. We were still using energy, industry was still churning its wheels, and decarbonizing those sectors is going to be much more difficult than just individual choices that we make.
So have researchers been able to learn anything new about humanity's effect on climate change because of the pandemic?
You know, there's going to be some interesting things. So there was reductions in industry, for instance, and that meant that there were fewer pollutants, industrial pollutants going into the atmosphere. And that's going to allow us to sort of understand, for instance, the impact of industrial aerosols, which also are an important feature of the climate story. They reflect sunlight in certain locations and actually cool the planet. A reduction in that is going to tell us something about how sensitive the Earth is to those aerosols. So there will be, I think, interesting experiments that have been run. But the overall story here is still that greenhouse gases have been increasing, and that the march upward in those gases and the consequence climate change is something that's continued largely unabated.
Umair, where do we stand on implementing more clean energy solutions in the U.S. in particular? I know that's something President-elect Biden has talked about.
Right. President-elect Biden has set a target of zeroing out the greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S. economy by 2050, but has also said that he wants to decarbonize the entire electricity system by about 2035. And that's just 15 years from now, which means we really have to start making aggressive changes now. In terms of practical things, I mean, we recently saw a big boost to that with this spending bill that was just passed by the government and signed into law by President Trump. This is that $900 billion COVID relief bill and also this $1.4 trillion omnibus spending bill, you know, because our Congress doesn't really do anything unless there's a crisis. Basically, they were able to pass some major energy legislation, and that contained some things like major investments in clean energy research, development, and deployment, but also updates to this treaty called the Montreal Protocol. And this is an agreement that limits pollutants that damage the ozone layer. But these same pollutants also are major heat-trapping gases. And this amendment to it, called the Kigali Amendment, basically commits the United States to phasing out these hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, by 85% over the next 15 years. And this has a huge impact on the global climate, because if you were to measure the impact of these heat-trapping gases, what we reduce would avert about half a degree of global warming by the end of the century. And also there were some extenders for tax credits for wind and solar energy development. But beyond that, you know, President-elect Biden has also set out his agenda and his team, and he's picked out
several leaders that have not just really good environmental bona fides on climate change, but also social justice. Say, for instance, you know, Representative Deb Haaland, who was selected to lead the Department of the Interior. She would be the first Native American cabinet secretary, and she's also been an opponent of pipelines and drilling on public land, and also has advocated for Native American communities across the country. And similarly, Michael Regan, who was selected from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality to head the EPA. He's also had a strong focus on climate change and the environment, but also on issues of social justice and racial and inequalities and things like that, and how the environment affects there. So we get a sense of what the priorities are going to be over the next 4 years.
Well, we've talked on this show a fair amount about what the Biden administration's climate change policy could look like, and we'll tweet some of those links out so folks can revisit those conversations. But thanks for that quick snapshot of his priorities as we understand them today. So, Jason, back to the stimulus bill. What can you walk us through the significance of what some of the impact could be to reducing the impact of climate change, like the reduction of hydrofluorocarbons, for example?
Well, I think hydrofluorocarbons is an important one, as Umair described. You know, this is something that we replaced chlorofluorocarbons with, and that was a really important move in the context of reducing the ozone hole. But as Umair mentioned, these are incredibly potent greenhouse gases. They are 100 to 1,000 times more potent than CO2, for instance. So reducing those and really targeting those as an important greenhouse gas is important on the order of several tenths of a degree of warming that we'll save. But, you know, more important, and just I think thinking back or looking at the larger picture here, all of the team that Umair mentioned and the parts of the omnibus bill that focus on climate change measures, you know, that's just an about face from what we've had over the last 4 years with an administration that has failed to acknowledge that climate change is even an issue. So I think in terms of the seriousness with which this incoming administration is going to take climate change and the team that they're putting together, it's just a measure of the seriousness and the urgency with which the Biden administration is going to look at climate change. And frankly, that's what we need. I mean, we've lost a lot of time over the last 4 years, and we've lost a lot of time over longer periods of time really failing to address climate change with the kind of urgency that's necessary. And it's at least encouraging that these initial signs from the Biden administration and what Congress has done through the omnibus bill, that we might actually take climate change seriously with the urgency that it deserves over the next 4 years of this administration.
So following up on that, Umair, are there initiatives or policies that President Trump is enacting on his way out of office that could have long-lasting implications for climate change?
Right. I mean, as Jason mentioned, you know, the last 4 years undoing all the rollbacks on environmental regulations, on things like energy efficiency and opening public lands to mining and drilling, that's just going to be a huge agenda item. And it's going to take a long time just to undo those changes under a Biden administration. But right at between now and when President-elect Biden gets sworn in, I mean, President Trump has been signing new authorizations for drilling and mining on public lands, new rollbacks on some of these environmental regulations. Recently, there was a rollback on efficiency regulations on things like shower heads, for instance. And, you know, these are small things that actually add up to big benefits, things like, you know, getting our appliances to use less electricity and do more. Those have major effects that help redound to greenhouse gases. And so seeing those things still being done is a little bit disheartening for our ambitions in terms of limiting greenhouse gases. And that, on the other hand, though, because these are being done through the White House, through executive authority, these are things that can be undone through the White House and executive authority. And we often see this, you know, back and forth between administrations. But again, this is just going to be more things for the Biden administration to have to do in order to enact their goals and to meet their targets of, you know, zeroing out emissions from our entire economy by the middle of the century.
Jason, I know you have young kids, and I'm wondering, as a parent and climate scientist, how you're feeling about this moment. Are you hopeful?
Well, let me say a few things about kids. First of all, I have a 3- and a 5-year-old. So, you know, with regard to this being a generational issue, a lot of kids who are being born today, or kids like mine who are young, they're going to live to the end of the century, which is, you know, in the climate change world, we often project to the end of 2100, of course. Things don't stop at that point. But, you know, at this point, that's within a human lifetime. And so all of these negative impacts of climate change that we often project out to the end of the century that when I started studying this seemed like it was so far away, really is within a human lifetime and is going to be the world that my kids inherit. And so, you know, that is an important thing to recognize, how close that reality is. And we have the power to shape it. We have the power to change it through our actions now. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. With regard to, you know, my kids, I think I haven't started talking to them about the doom and gloom of climate change at this point. But I will tell you what we do is we spend a lot of time outside. They're becoming they're natural naturalists in so many ways, and they're learning about their world. We go birding. They learn the names of plants and so on, even in Manhattan. And I think on some level, you have to understand how significant and unique this planet is before you can appreciate the kinds of massive impacts that we're causing it. And that's what I'm trying to teach my kids at this point before we get on to the more serious stuff about what needs to be done to maintain that.
Umair, how about you? Not even as a reporter, but as a human, how do you feel as we head into 2021?
Right. I mean, I think echoing what Jason said, I mean, we're seeing a pretty abrupt change from where things were over the past 4 years. But we also have a lot of work that's cut out for us. I mean, I think we have a lot of ground to make up, the United States in particular, as a global leader and a major economy. A lot of countries are looking to us, and this is really a place where we have to step up. And, you know, as Jason noted, like, we do project out to 2100, but 2050 is also where a lot of our benchmarks are. And 2050 is the world that a lot of working adults are going to retire into. And that's an era that a lot of us are going to see right now. So it's not just for our children's future, but perhaps for our own future, for our own self-interest, that we really should be starting aggressively to mitigate our greenhouse gas emissions, because this is a world that we are going to see play out in front of us.
Umair Irfan is a staff writer at Vox covering climate change and science, and Jason Smerdon, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University.
This is Mary Youngblood in Wasilla, Alaska. Climate change has directly affected me and my family. Obviously, we're in Alaska. There's a lot less snow. We have a lot more ice. And we don't have a nice, fun, cold, snowy winter weather going on. I hope, with Biden coming in, to see aggressive moves away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy sources.
This is Julie from Sarasota, Florida. I sincerely hope that Biden's administration reinstates the environmental controls that Trump had let lapse or removed. And I really hope that he focuses his attention on renewable and clean energy.
This is Jean calling from Seattle, Washington. Climate change was very much in evidence this past summer with hazardous levels of wildfire smoke in our city. This made the air nearly unbreathable and increased the claustrophobia of pandemic times. We couldn't even safely go outside. I'm hoping that the Biden administration will be able to de-emphasize our reliance on fossil fuels and support solar and wind energy.
Callie Crossley in for Tanzina Vega this week. Nearly 400 treaties exist in the U.S. to protect tribal lands and hunting and fishing rights, and they have rarely been honored by federal and local governments. But that might be changing. Last month, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer shut down a controversial pipeline in northern Michigan, citing, among other things, an 1836 treaty that guarantees indigenous rights to hunt and fish in that area. Indigenous treaties are also helping secure environmental wins in other areas. Tribes in Washington State won a case in 2018 to restore their fisheries. And last month, Oregon and California announced plans to remove four dams on the Klamath River based on treaty rights. Asserting treaty rights has the potential to increase environmental protection in many parts of the country, and tribal members invoking treaty rights can sometimes make a stronger legal claim than non-native citizens. But there are so many new treaty violations that they can't be corrected fast enough, and some legal experts worry that sweeping treaty assertions that are unsuccessful in court could set a dangerous precedent. Matthew Fletcher is the director of Michigan State University's Indigenous Law and Policy Center, member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and a tribal judge. Matthew, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
First off, can you explain how treaties were actually intended to protect the environment and what specifically they protect?
Sure. So treaties really fundamentally, what they do is establish a homeland for Indian people, for Indian tribes. So a treaty typically would say the tribe would sell off its historical traditional territories in exchange for a permanent reservation. And that would usually have some sort of boundary established. So that homeland, that reservation is a homeland. And whatever is contained in that homeland is protected by the treaty specifically. And whatever resources are needed even outside of the reservation are protected as well. Things like water, access to wildlife, fish and game, that sort of thing. All of those are protected by the treaty.
When did things start to fall apart with these treaties and why weren't they respected and enforced?
Things fell apart within a few years of the treaties being negotiated. In most instances, you would see the introduction of settlers from outside the area. They would come in, they would want to come onto reservation lands, or they would want to take control over waters and other resources that the reservation lands depend on. And the United States government very rarely would do anything about those encroachments. In fact, they would often encourage those encroachments. And then over time, the United States Congress would pass laws designed to allow for the introduction of new people into reservation lands and divert resources away from the tribes.
What would the environmental landscape look like in this country if the treaties had been enforced throughout our history?
Well, there would be a lot more trees. There would be a lot more clean water. And there would be more resources available to the tribes. So, you know, that there would be, you know, a much greater, a greener environmental landscape throughout the country, wherever there is Indian country.
Matthew, is it common to use treaty rights for environmental preservation?
Well, probably not until the last two decades. So treaty rights are usually litigated on the question of access to fish and game or reservation boundaries or reservation lands. But there's always been this implied notion that if a treaty is designed to establish a homeland, then it must be also designed to allow for the preservation of the resources needed to fulfill the purposes of that homeland. So in the West, you'll see a lot of cases in the last few decades where the tribes are talking about, you know, the access to water even off the reservation, access to fishing game even off the reservation, to allow for the purposes of the reservation to be fulfilled. And on occasion, you'll see a treaty like the treaties in Michigan and the treaties in Washington State that explicitly allow for access to fishing game off the reservation. Now, what you at the beginning of the program, in the introduction, you talked about a case in 2018 where the courts have affirmed the right or the protection of the environment as a means of fulfilling the purposes of the treaty. You need to have a decent environment in order to have fish and game and clean water. And that kind of litigation is just really beginning. And we're starting to see more and more cases along those lines now.
Were you surprised to see Governor Whitmer use treaty rights as a reason to oppose a pipeline? And what do you think prompted her to do that? And was it politically advantageous to her?
All of that is right. So I was not terribly surprised to see Governor Whitmer refer to treaty rights. Indian tribes have often been allies of the state government when the state government is looking at restricting polluters or restricting the kind of economic activity that creates problems for the environment. So the reference to the treaty of 1836 was a pleasant surprise in that the tribes really have been advocating for many years as a means of cutting back on these threats to the environment. And I guess the surprise comes from the fact that not so many years ago, 1970s, 1980s, the state of Michigan and the tribes were at loggerheads when it came to treaty rights. And the state litigated fervently and went to Congress to try to get the treaty rights abrogated by Congress to make them go away because they were so hostile to the assertion of treaty rights by the tribes. And now we've come full circle where the state is looking at the protection of Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Superior, etc. And it refers to treaty rights to say, well, we've got to protect the rights of our citizens. Indian people are citizens of the state. And so it makes perfect sense now for the state to say, among other things, that the treaty protects the access to that water and the clean water in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and Lake Superior.
What's the difference between fighting for the right to fish and fighting for the conservation of the resource that allows you to exercise that right?
Well, fighting for the right to fish assumes that there are fish and that there's clean water and a good habitat for the fish. So it requires the tribes, and I suppose the state, if it's going to assert these rights, I guess, on behalf of the tribes, it requires the tribes to prove that there is an additional right inherent in the treaty that in order to have the access to resources like fish, you have to have a clean environment. You have to have a successful habitat for the fish to thrive. So whenever treaty rights are litigated in court, the tribes and whoever is siding with the tribes, be it a state government, or the United States or whomever, has to go back and prove that in, say, 1836, that there was an intent to negotiate for access to fish on and off the reservation. And that's one difficult thing that, you know, is something that has already been done. It's been established. But every time you litigate treaty rights, you have to hire historians, ethnohistorians, anthropologists, experts to write basically a book every single time that you litigate these cases to prove that the Indian people of 1836 believed that that's what the treaty did. And once you've done that to understand access to fish, then you've got to do the additional step of proving that it's access to a clean environment and a successful habitat. And that requires yet another round of complex litigation.
What have we seen in recent years in terms of how government officials relate to these treaties?
So it definitely is a recent trend. You started to see this in the pipeline case, in the pipelines in North Dakota and elsewhere in the Great Plains, where tribes are asserting that a pipeline that runs through traditional territories of Indian tribes is actually foreclosed, is prohibited by treaty rights. So in the case of the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline dispute, the tribes are asserting and still are asserting that if the pipeline breaks or ruptures, then the resulting impact will destroy the access to water that the tribes have negotiated for in their treaty rights, in their treaty to preserve a homeland. So this argument has been made. This type of argument has been made more recently, but it goes all the way back, you know, a century into the 1900s, where the United States Supreme Court acknowledged that the purpose of a reservation is to create a homeland. And in order to have a homeland, you have to have access to water. And this access to water, clean water, and a livable reservation is the core of the argument that is rooted in treaty rights to protect the environment. And you're starting to see these cases again and again. You're starting to see political momentum behind the cases. Tribes don't really like to litigate treaty rights because it's incredibly complex and expensive, but it also puts the core of their legal being to the test in court. And you can never really tell what's going to happen in court, even if you have a really strong legal claim. So politically, however, you don't really have to make all of those arguments. You don't have to prove to a court in a way that that puts things to the test. You can just say, we have these treaty rights. Here's our position on the treaty. Here's our position on the environment. And you can create a sort of phalanx of political power. The tribes lined up to make that argument in a political manner in the political arena, and it's much more successful.
So how has the collaboration of tribes with the climate movement changed the political power that tribes have, if it has?
Well, I think it has. Back in the early days of the treaty rights fights, you would see a lot of non-Indians line up against the tribes to side with the states and say there's no treaty rights to hunt and fish. And they were in opposition to the tribes because they thought that access to fish and game was a sort of a zero-sum game. And we're starting to realize that with the environmental movement and the conservation movement, which tend to be on opposite political sides, we all have the same interests with tribes. And the tribes want to protect the environment so that there's access to fish and game. The conservation movement wants to protect the environment because there's access to fishing, to get access to fish and game. And the environmental movement is interested in protecting the environment for the purposes of protecting the environment. So we're all lined up. These three groups that at times were at loggerheads over treaty rights are now suddenly on the same side in a lot of these issues. And, you know, you add in the reality that in the past few decades, tribes are large employers regionally in some of these rural areas. And a lot of people are starting to side with the tribes generally because they depend on the tribes for their livelihoods.
Some people say it's a tedious process to try and make a dent in the many, many treaty violations over the past century. Does it make sense legally to use this tactic?
Well, it doesn't. It's incredibly expensive, but at the same time, anytime a tribe is threatened, anytime a tribe thinks that its treaty rights are threatened or its homeland is threatened, they are willing to make that decision to expend those resources, to put everything on the line. Keep in mind that treaties are the core of the existence in many ways of modern day tribes. If you ever want to get a tribe riled up politically, threaten their treaty rights, and they will absolutely line up against whatever power is making that claim. But it is tedious, and it's very expensive and complex. And it's a much easier argument to make in the political arena than it is in court. But that doesn't stop tribes. I mean, they will absolutely make that argument now. But they've only really been able to do that in the past 4 or 5 decades. And it's for many of the tribes in Michigan and in California, those tribes are really just coming into modern existence with a sense of self-determination since the 80s and 90s. And so for them, it's very much this kind of claim in court or in the political arena is very much a new kind of arrangement, a new situation for them, and a really good one. They're actually able to make decisions for themselves and decide when and where to assert treaty rights.
Now, are you worried about this setting a kind of dangerous precedent?
Well, you're always worried when a tribe goes to court and loses. If you get a court ruling that goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court that says something along the lines of, you know, we're not going to enforce implied treaty rights in the same way that we would enforce explicit treaty rights. And that's always a threat, and it can threaten all tribes. But what we're seeing in the Supreme Court right now is justices like Justice Gorsuch saying that we're not interested in the politics of Indian country. We're not interested in how, you know, what the impacts of these cases are going to be. We're going to read the treaty. We're going to look at the way Indian people understood that treaty at the time it was negotiated. And that's all that matters. And if you have those kind of judges on the bench, they're, you know, what they call textualists. And that's basically the kind of judges that are being appointed to the federal and state benches right now, the tribes are in a really good position, relatively speaking.
How do treaty rights intersect with tribal sovereignty? I think that's something that many people don't understand.
Well, you know, just in the past half century, since the 1970s, tribes have been able to govern themselves. Before the 1970s, the federal government, through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, ran Indian country completely. Tribes were not able to make decisions on how to expend resources. They were often not allowed to assert treaty rights for environmental purposes or any other purposes. The federal government used to be able to decide who the tribes could hire as lawyers, if they could even hire a lawyer. But since the 70s, the tribes have that power now themselves. The federal government has turned over its obligations to the tribes to govern Indian country. And once that happened, it allows tribes to make a choice in any given moment when they feel threatened on their treaty rights issues to make the claim, when and where to make the claim, how to make the claim, which lawyers they're going to hire to make the claim, that sort of thing. And that's how those things intersect. Tribes are very circumspect on how they assert treaty rights. But when they do assert treaty rights, it's a little bit like asserting a nuclear option, especially in court, because it's sort of an existential question for the tribes whenever they go to court on treaty rights. And so they're very careful about picking and choosing moments to make that decision. So in Michigan, for example, the tribes have intervened in all sorts of legal proceedings to challenge the pipeline that runs under Lake Michigan, but they have not yet asserted that there's a treaty right to kick that pipeline out. And if all of these other proceedings fail, and it doesn't really look like they will, maybe then the tribes make a choice that it's time to bust out the treaty rights claim and assert it then.
So given that, what do you expect to see over the next year in terms of how treaty rights will impact environmental protection?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of tribes making claims. You know, climate change is a really big deal. You see forest fires in the West. You see pollution of water supplies in the Great Plains. I think tribes at this point are getting ready. They're dusting off the treaty rights arguments. And you might see some really big cases. I think the Standing Rock Sioux case involving the Dakota Access Pipeline is pending in court. You're seeing cases that involve, say, the Shoshone-Bannock tribes, preservation of its resources, and suits against polluters are pending in the Supreme Court. And those kinds of things are really important cases that can establish that treaty rights really can protect the environment. And you're going to see, obviously, what's going on with Line 5 under Lake Michigan going to be a really big case right now with the tribes lined up with the state of Michigan against the pipeline company.
Matthew Fletcher is the director of Michigan State University's Indigenous Law and Policy Center, member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and a tribal judge. Thank you very much for joining me, Matthew.
Absolutely.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Callie Crossley, in this week for Tanzina Vega. Writer and producer Shonda Rhimes is best known for her work on a number of successful network television dramas, including Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and How to Get Away with Murder. This month, Rhimes is making the leap to streaming with her Netflix debut, Bridgerton. The show is a romantic drama set in the high society of early 19th century England. But unlike so many period pieces that depict the era with nearly all white casts, Rhimes and the show's creator, Chris Van Dusen, took a largely colorblind approach to casting for Bridgerton. In the series, King George III's wife, Queen Charlotte, is black. Here's actress Anjua Ando as Lady Danbury in a scene from the show, explaining how the marriage has changed their society.
Look at our queen. Look at our king. Look at their marriage. Look at everything it is doing for us, allowing us to become. We were two separate societies, divided by color, until a king fell in love with one of us. Love, your grace, conquers all.
And while much of the show is fictionalized, some historians do actually believe that the real Queen Charlotte had African ancestry. For more on Bridgerton, I'm joined by Iramide Tinubu, film critic and entertainment writer. Thanks for being here, Iramide.
Hi, Callie. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited. In the book series that Bridgerton is based on, the characters are white. How much do you think the speculation around Queen Charlotte's race factored into the decision to cast actors of color in the show?
It definitely did. In Julia Quinn's novel, there is no mention of Queen Charlotte. So I think that was a really interesting way for Rhymes and Van Dusen to bring in race without really talking about it explicitly.
Would you give us a quick plot summary for our audience members who aren't familiar with Bridgerton?
Certainly. The series is set in 1813 during the Regency era. It's the height of the marriage market in London. And there's a young woman, Daphne Bridgerton. She's the eldest daughter of the esteemed Bridgerton family. And she's being presented on the marriage market. She does not want to just be married to any old man. So she ends up plotting this scheme with the Duke of Hastings, her brother's oldest friend. And they begin to date each other as a way for women to leave him alone and for more matches to meet her interests. But they actually fall in love with one another inadvertently.
We just heard a scene where they explain why the world of the show is racially integrated. Is race discussed explicitly at other points in the series?
Not at all. That is the only point in which race is mentioned, which I think is really interesting, because if race isn't this huge backdrop or isn't a huge plot point of a narrative, you can just get into the scandal and then the narrative of things without all of that history sort of backing up the series.
What do you think about the decision not to center the plot around race? Does it work for the story?
I think it works really well for Bridgerton. I think it's an excellent way to just let people enjoy this period and let Shonda and Chris Van Dusen do their thing with the series. It doesn't really take away from anything in the plot. I know so often when we look at this time period, people of color are enslaved or they're servants, but it allows everyone to just be in this really salacious, grandiose time.
How does the approach to addressing race in Bridgerton compare to how race factors in some of Rhymes' other shows?
I think it's very different. So she's always been known to do this colorblind casting, as we've seen with Grey's Anatomy and Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder. However, race is explicitly talked about because the leads for Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder in particular are Black women. For this, it's very different because, you know, it's a past time period and it's really about women. It's about misogyny. It's about sexism and the things that women had to do in order to survive back in that time.
There have been some other recent period pieces that have either used colorblind casting or addressed race and racism more explicitly. Now, how do some of those works compare to Bridgerton?
Definitely. If you look at Dev Patel and the personal history of David Copperfield, which came out recently, he's an Indian British actor and he plays Charles Dickens' titular character. And race isn't discussed in the film at all. But it's we've seen so many depictions of David Copperfield that I think no one was really bothered or moved by it. Something like Belle, which is Amma Santi's 2013 novel, with Gugu, it's about a real-life character, a mixed-race woman during the 1700s who comes of age in London society as well. So I think it has it's been done definitely before, but I think this is the most mainstream way that it's been seen previously.
Now, does that mean there's a growing recognition among Hollywood producers that there actually is an audience for period pieces with more diverse casts?
I think so, certainly. I think, you know, Hollywood is definitely trying to keep up with the times, or at least starting to keep up with the times. And I think if you don't have, you know, any sort of race narrative in your plot or in your story, it's definitely worthwhile to see people of all colors. You know, there's Asian characters in Bridgerton, white characters, Black characters. You can see a really diverse world as long as you're not, you know, doing a disservice to actual history and what people of color have gone through in their lives.
Were you a fan of period pieces growing up?
Definitely. I was forced to read Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, all of those.
Forced
by my father. I grew up in a Nigerian household, so he was really, really a big fan of literature. So for me, I'd always just imagined myself in these time period. Anything that Jane Austen wrote, I love period pieces. I loved Little Women when it came out last year. So I think it's definitely room for all types of people to see themselves in these time periods without being enslaved people or servants.
So that means you see yourself represented in these stories?
Definitely. Or I can certainly relate to the women and the things that they go through, especially because, you know, until 1970, women couldn't even have their own bank accounts. So you see Daphne trying to make a way for herself and for her family by marrying the best person that she can.
Are there other genres where you think it would make sense for Hollywood to take a colorblind approach to casting?
Definitely. I think that most genres, you're able to do it as long as you're not sort of putting, you know, Julia Roberts as Harriet Tubman or anything crazy like that. But you look at horror, what Jordan Peele has done with the horror genre. Romance certainly could use a lot more people of color in it. But I think people are slowly coming along. Superheroes, you see that genre start to shift and change, especially with Disney Plus's announcement of all of the various series and films that they're about to debut. So I think we're coming along. It's not quite as fast as I would like, but we're making a way here.
Is there excitement about Bridgerton? Are you hearing that?
Certainly. I think it's number one, both in the UK and in the US. So I think people are really enticed to see what's going to happen. I know Julia Quinn has always had a really huge, robust fan base. So they're really excited to see what Shonda Rhimes has done with it.
Aramide Tinubu is a film critic and entertainment writer. Thanks, Aramide.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can download us wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also send me a tweet at Callie Crossley. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.